You're listening to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. Good evening, I'm Al Voner, and this is The Public Eye. My guest this week is author and educator Matt Klavan and his new book, The Battle of Negro Fort. He's done some really interesting research into the dramatic story of an all-but-forgotten community of fugitive slaves and Native Americans who were living in Spanish Florida long before the United States took possession of that region of the country. And during that period, something known as Negro Fort, in which future President Andrew Jackson had played a big part in its destruction. And then we'll be talking with Matt Klavan for the next half hour about Negro Fort and his research for the book. Matt, nice to have you with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
You and I talked a little bit beforehand, and I always tell people I'm kind of a history buff and did a lot of love to read about the Civil War. Like to read about post Civil War and how we got to be the nation that we are, and the Civil Rights Movement and all that. But Matt, this had to be even for you the needle in the proverbial haystack. Negro Fort. These were runaway slaves who basically working alongside or cooperating with the British, right?
Right, absolutely. So often now when you hear about runaway slaves, and historians increasingly are really paying attention to the number of fugitive slaves and their political impact. And, most people know that the Civil War does not happen without fugitive slaves, the Fugitive Slave Law, resistance to the Fugitive Slave Law. I mean, this is just a huge issue and controversy in the middle of the 19th century. But what my book really focuses on is a total different group of runaway slaves who in the 18-teens are heading south towards freedom. Spanish Florida for years had a very liberal policy towards runaway slaves. Spanish Florida was desperate for men, quite honestly, bodies of men to serve in the Spanish military, to serve in the Spanish garrisons throughout the territory of East and West Florida. And for many years, to sort of get back at the English, they welcomed runaway slaves from the English colonies, and then when the colonies revolted and became the United States, these slaves continued the tradition of their ancestors, and they continued to flee towards Spanish Florida. So by the time of the War of 1812, this is a major, major problem for slave owners. And when Britain invades the American South through Spanish Florida during the War of 1812, they do everything in their power to defeat the Americans, and that includes arming their slaves. So the number of slaves to Spanish Florida only increases. The British are also arming and funding Native American resistance to the United States. And so by the time of the end of the War of 1812, you have a huge presence of pro-British fugitive slaves and Native Americans in Spanish Florida. And when the British pull out of Spanish Florida, their allies refuse to move. They have nowhere to go. And so now the United States is faced with this problem of slaves continuing to escape south, Native Americans boldly resisting American expansion, and it literally blows up in what's called the Battle of Negro Fort in the summer of 1816.
Matt, I think a lot of people would be saying, oh, well, okay, we're talking about 1816, 1817, how many slaves could even read and write? So how did they know that if they travel south, they're either going to be welcomed, as you said, by working alongside either the Spanish who control that region at the time, or partnering with the British. I mean, right. How did the word get out?
Well, I'll tell you. There's two ways. So there's just the oral tradition, because this goes back more than 100 years with the British to the early to mid 1700s. But what's some of the most incredible documentation I've seen is during the War of 1812. The British are literally handing out flyers, and this is no exaggeration. They have printed out copies of documents, these proclamations, a series of them. Some of them are offering freedom to fugitive slaves if they enlist in what's called the British Corps of Colonial Marines. And then there's also a list of a series of proclamations that offer Native Americans, promises these Native Americans that they will be able to keep the land of their ancestors if they align with the British against the United States. So, today we have, things go viral through text messages and emails, but during the War of 1812, there are thousands of these documents being handed out by black and Indian allies of the British to just thousands of people. So even in like Louisiana, on the eve of the Battle of New Orleans slaves are seeing these handouts that are offering them freedom if they join the British and fight for the British cause.
So two things came, you know, when I got to that part of the book, two things came to mind. One is, okay, looking at the period of time, slavery was certainly in full bloom for those parts of the United States that were you know, developed, and people living there, slave owners felt that they had a right to have slaves. And then secondly, the fact that British and even to some degree the Spanish, to Americans, to people who had slaves, to people who believed in slavery at that time, including Andrew Jackson, I get the sense that they felt that their sovereignty, that their land, that their investment and their possessions, and that being the slaves,
right,
were being threatened by both Spanish and British, right, for lack of a better term, counterinsurgents. So is that the way? I mean, I'm trying to, in my mind, I'm trying to say, why would Andrew, why would you go and just take over that little, bomb that little place and just let them go? But they felt that that there was an egregious act against right, Americans, right?
Right. Yeah, and I think it's again, it's two things. I think you have, there's an actual threat that Negro Fort poses to the Southern plantations, the culture of slavery in the American South. I mean, it literally is Negro Fort is receiving, it's inviting runaway slaves. So if you're a slave owner and you lose 5 slaves or 10 slaves over the course of several months to Negro Fort, I mean, you lose money, and this is your investment. This is capital. It's like land. You know, slavery is one of the most valuable things in the entire, in the history of the antebellum South. So that's one issue. But the other thing, I think even more significantly, it's symbolic. And what Negro Fort represents is a place of black freedom. And, everyone knows that in the antebellum South, with the expansion of cotton and the cotton gin, slavery becomes a very different thing than it was in the colonial period. And in the colonial period of British North America, I mean, slaves were treated horribly, but arguably it only gets worse for slaves with cotton expansion. And as you need more slaves, there's more justification of why we need to enslave so many people, and there's the dehumanization of African-American people, and it really is the treatment of them as property and no longer recognizing them legally as people. And so this whole culture emerges. And if, while this is happening, you have in Spanish Florida a fort of maybe 1,000 runaway slaves, hundreds of Indian allies, and these, it's dominated by many men who served in the British Marines during the War of 1812 against the United States, and it is just, it is a very bad symbol for Southern slave owners who are trying to demonstrate that this new way of life, this new slave society, it needs to persist moving forward. So Andrew Jackson is among, the leadership class of the early South, and they just see that we have to get rid of this, not only for practical reasons, runaway slaves are escaping to Negro Fort, but also symbolically. I mean, they're trying to establish not only this plantation economy based on cotton, but let's be honest, they're also establishing white supremacy,
right,
to an unprecedented level.
Right.
And while the Spanish colonies sanctioned slavery, British colonies sanctioned slavery, they looked at this different than American slave owners did in the early 1800s.
Yeah, I want to move on to that part because that's really the connector to all this. But another thing, because it's mentioned throughout the book, numerous times you mentioned the fact that, as you said, African Americans who were enslaved by slave owners ran to this place, but they also I noticed an affinity, if you will, with Indians, Native Americans. Were they? Did they feel the same frustrations? Did they feel the same way that African Americans did?
They did. Well, it's really a bifurcated response. There's two different responses, and so yes, one of the most exciting part of the research of this, writing this book, is the alliances that you see. You see runaway slaves, you see Native Americans from various tribes, Choctaw, Creek, all sorts of southeastern tribal peoples, and then you also have these British Marines. And, you know, sometimes the British are helping the Indians and encouraging slaves to run away simply out of strategic, you know, motivation. They're just trying to defeat the United States.
Right.
And so there is no genuine love for these people. That being said, there are a lot of British Marines on the ground. They are, you know, in some cases dying. They're sacrificing their own lives for what they call their black and brown brothers.
Mm.
And one of my favorite quotations of the entire book is when an American soldier during the War of 1812 complains. You know, he basically says these, you know, freaking British people, all they care about is freedom. They'll fight alongside Indians. They'll fight alongside the Negroes. They don't care about anything but freedom. And, you know, growing up in the United States, you think it's the Americans who are always the freedom fighters.
Yeah.
But in the War of 1812, from the perspective of slaves and Indians, at least on the Gulf Coast, it's the British who are the ones fighting for freedom. So I think it's a very ironic story.
Yeah, that stuck out in my mind, too. I know I'm thinking to myself, geez, I didn't think the British were that concerned about civil rights, if you will.
Right.
They almost seem to be reaching out in a very sympathetic tone, saying, look, I can't guarantee what's going to happen, but at least you got a fighting chance by siding with us, because you know, all the Americans are trying to do is enslave you, separate families, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Very interesting. I want to take a quick pause. We're going to be right back with Matt Klavan. You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Voner, and this is The Public Eye. Again, my guest this week is author and educator Matthew Klavan. His new book is The Battle of Negro Fort. And if you have any interest in civil rights, and this country has a long, long history of civil rights, then his book, The Battle of Negro Fort, talks about, but right after the Battle of the War of 1812, a small South Florida fort, actually was run by Spanish and then overtaken by British, where runaway slaves were urged to side with the British in their fight against Americans. Matt, so much, again, I go back to this idea that these people, the slaves who ran, were not highly educated, probably couldn't read or write. You talked about how they got them down there. Did they themselves, much of your research, did they really believe that either the Spanish or the British would, in other words, was it better with them than it was to stay on the plantations? And they believed that they had a fighting chance by siding with the British.
Absolutely. And there's at least three examples I talk about post-Battle of New Orleans. Actually, the first happens during the Battle of New Orleans, where fugitive slaves, you know, after several months of recruitment by the British, you know, we find them, you know, many of the men wearing red coats, having enlisted in the Marines, and as the War of 1812 winds down, American and sometimes Spanish slave owners send representatives to meet with these British officers in charge of all these runaway slaves, and interviews are allowed to take place. And in all three instances, literally these slaves, oftentimes men are chosen as the representatives, but also women are allowed to do this. They form a long line. You know, there's a table, literally a table set up with some of these representatives of the Spanish and or American slave owners. At one point, Andrew Jackson sends representatives from New Orleans. And they go to Mobile, Alabama. They go to the Apalachicola River. They go to what's called St. George's Island off the Florida coast. And they interview these former slaves, and they ask them, do you want to stay with the British now that the war is over, or would you like to return to the plantation, to your slave owners, and also, in many cases, to your friends and families?
Mm.
And out of, you know, several hundred slaves who are interviewed, maybe a dozen, roughly, return, you know, to their plantations. And, of course, the reason for doing that is they want to return to many of their friends and family members. It's certainly not out of a love of being enslaved.
Right.
But what you do have is hundreds of slaves who are given the chance, and they say, no, we'd rather roll our dice with the British. And, you know, and I'll repeat, you know, the British allow slavery at this time, not in England, mind you, but throughout the British colonies. You know, by 1808, Britain has gained a reputation of trying to end the Atlantic slave trade. They're freeing slaves globally. So Britain is really becoming a part of a global abolition movement. So their relationship with slavery is absolutely changing at this time. Well, for a runaway slave to join any European power that still sanctions slavery in their colonies is a very risky, dangerous thing.
Right.
That being said, the vast majority of these slaves, this is, you know, there's a historian who has a great book called The Slave's Gamble about the War of 1812, and this is the gamble that they're willing to take. You know, stay on the plantation, continue that life, or risk it all in the wilderness of Spanish Florida, you know, even after the British evacuate, and we're on our own, and the only people we might be able to rely on are Indian neighbors, and that's what they do. They go for it. And it's one of those rare instances in the history of slavery where slaves are given a choice, and they choose freedom no matter how precarious it may be.
Right.
Anything is better than returning to the status quo.
And now, going fast forward a little bit, you've got then General Andrew Jackson, who would eventually become president. You know, he didn't need, I mean, he won the war. I mean, he had gained fame. He was headed for bigger and better things, as they say. Negro Fort wasn't even on at the time, wasn't even on American soil. And you talked about the motivations, the reasons why. Well, they were runaway slaves. They were chattel. They were property of slave owners. Those are people who would maybe vote for. So, I mean, there's a lot of motivation for why Andrew Jackson would do something. But in reading the book, I mean, him directly, I mean, the order didn't come right away from him and saying, okay, destroy that place. Tell me a little bit about how. You know, they could have just, Matt, they could have just said, okay, fine, we beat you, you know, stay there, don't bother us, we'll find other slaves, you're not worth the effort. But they went after them. Why?
Yeah, well, you know, I'll tell you, for Andrew Jackson, it's personal. It's also personal for a lot of Army officers along the southern border. It's also personal for all these slave owners. And, you know, I'm with you. I wish... You know, so there's a big part of the book focuses on Benjamin Hawkins. He is arguably the most powerful, you know, bureaucrat for the federal government in the entire South, but definitely in the Deep South at this time. He's an Indian agent. He's the head Indian agent for all Indians south of the Ohio River from the 1790s through about 1815. And he actually has several of his slaves. They escaped Negro Fort. And he, like Jackson, is just adamant that we need to destroy this fort. We need to kill or capture all of the people inside its walls. And, you know, if he had, he very simply could have, you know, just sent representatives, and he does on occasion, but they're just there to sort of, quote unquote, spy on the fort and get, you know, intel.
Right, right.
But they very easily could have just tried to negotiate or discuss, you know, work out, arrange the return of his three or four slaves. You know, I don't know how that would have turned out, but it's possible that those slaves could have been returned without the death of hundreds of these people. But just for these slave owners, I think this is just this very pivotal time in American history. And it's like, if we, the slave owners, are going to do this, if we are going to stake a claim for, you know, westward expansion of slavery, but also southern expansion of slavery, if we are going to establish once and for all the dominance of white Americans over all people of color, then we need to just obliterate this fort. And so what they do, Al, is they use Negro Fort as a political football. They exploit its existence. And I think you even insinuated these people at this fort, they just want to be left alone. Like, they're not trying to start a revolution.
Right.
They aren't slave, you know, rebels. They're runaways. They just want to be left alone. You know, they don't care if they're in the wilds of Spanish Florida. They just want freedom. But for these white Americans, these slave owners, this is something they can't tolerate. It just sets a horrible precedent. And so for Jackson and Hawkins and General Edmund Gaines, you know, they're all pro-slavery. They're all slave owners. And they just decide that, you know, they early get in their mind that this thing has to be destroyed. And, you know, at some point they even make the decision, you know, I think at first they just want all these slave owners to see their slaves returned to them. But early on, they decide, now, we'd rather just destroy it all. And even if we have to kill all of these people, it has to be eliminated. So they very early on make this fateful decision that, you know, regardless of what it does to America's reputation as, you know, a freedom-loving people, we got to destroy this fort. And what's really, for me, distressing is they do it and they succeed. But people who are neutral on the issue of slavery, people who don't own slaves, even people who are anti-slavery, they kind of keep their mouths shut.
Yeah.
And it's not until years later you get Northerners with the organized abolition movement that Negro Ford becomes, again, the symbol of freedom, of black freedom that it once was. But unfortunately for American history, everyone just sort of remains quiet. And so the pro-slavery, militant, violent white supremacists, they win. And it just it really is a black mark on early American history.
Yeah, and that came, you know, you clearly define that in the book, especially as you get toward the latter end. I mean, it all comes together. Matt, in the few moments we have, I got to ask you, I mean, this is a major event and part and parcel, as you clearly stated, and as many people know by now, certainly one of the foundations of the, you know, of one slavery, but more importantly, civil rights and everything that this country is still dealing with to this day here in the year 2019. But let me ask you, how many, I mean, so often, I mean, both of us are very familiar with the 60s, the uprising, the revolts that took place, the violence that took place in many American cities, especially down south, as it related to slavery. How many African Americans today are knowledgeable about Negro Ford? Because I never ever heard a Martin Luther King or anyone else in the civil rights movement ever say, and don't forget, you know, this all started with you know, an episode that didn't have to take place that way. Negro Ford, is it part of that? Is it in their consciousness?
For some people, yes. You know, I lived in Florida for years. I have taken student groups to the site of the former Negro Fort, which is it's still this incredible, beautiful, isolated state reserve right now. It's really an incredible place. But you know, on the way to Negro Fort, we'd stop at fast food restaurants, we'd stop at gas stations, and we'd stop at local diners. Within, you know, a half an hour, this is an isolated place, it's still wilderness, but maybe half an hour, the first town, you know, close to the what's called Prospect Bluff is the hill where this fort was located. We would ask people, I've asked people, do you know about Negro Fort? Or people would ask us, because we're on a, you know, a big bus, what are you all doing out here? What kind of field trip are you on? And we said, we're here to see Negro Fort. And black and white people who've grown up there their entire life look at me like I'm crazy. Like, what? What are you talking about? What is this place?
Never
wow,
heard
that's
of it,
amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, the first book I wrote was based on a doctoral dissertation on the Haitian Revolution. And what inspired me to write that book was how, in the early to mid-19th century, pretty much every American knew about this incredible slave revolt that birthed the island or the nation of Haiti. And, you know, for whatever reason, you know, in late 20th century, early 21st century, when I was writing that book, very few people knew about it. But in the Civil War and earlier, everyone knew about it. During the 1960s, Santana had a song about Toussaint Louverture from the Haitian Revolution. So, you know, there are times of, you know, sort of social upheaval, social revolution, you know, 1960s come to mind, the Civil War comes to mind,
oh, yeah,
and things like the Haitian Revolution, the Battle of Negro Fort, they become, you know, historical markers that are remembered.
Yeah,
but unfortunately, throughout much of other more peaceful and tranquil times in American history, these things are forgotten.
Yeah.
And so absolutely my motivation for writing this book is I've always been enamored and fascinated with this story. And to be honest, a lot of historians have gone back and forth over the years, but just the general public is not aware of Negro Fort. And I think that's very unfortunate. And that was the real intention of this book, to try to get high school teachers to read about this, learn about this, teach their students, to have college students, you know, on their summer vacation, read about Negro Fort, read about this early form of civil rights activism, this early form of you know, violent white supremacy. These things are relevant today, right? And so I think it's just goal of the book. I hope it does, at least to some extent. It just brings it to the general public's awareness that this thing happened, and it matters. It even matters today.
And I want to add as we close out this evening that, and you put it perfectly, Matt, that you don't have to be a history buff or someone who just devours nonfiction history books. This, as you said, was an early form of activism as it related to African-American, both slavery and African-Americans and their relationship to their white counterparts here in this country. And yet it slipped through the cracks, but thank God you brought it to light. The book is The Battle of Negro Fort. My guest is the author this week, Matt Klavan. Matt, if people want to just post questions to you directly, just get a little bit more about your background, is there a way they can reach you? Is there a website or an email?
Just through the University of Houston. We have a website through the History Department, or my email is mjclavan@universityofhouston.edu or houston.edu, or mjclavan@uh.edu. But the University of Houston, I have a website through their History Department page as well.
Terrific. And the book, again, is The Battle of Negro Fort, and a great read. And Matt did it in such a way that it flows very nicely. And you really do get a clear sense of what took place. And again, as Matt said, an early form of civil rights activism long before it was even named for that. So a great read. Any questions about the broadcast, you can give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. Certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. Or just go to our safe and secure website, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's WICN.org. Again, my guest this week I want to thank is Matt Klavan, author and educator. The book is The Battle of Negro Fort. For the public eye, this is Al Vona.